Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. In this week's podcast, market volatility continues to dominate the news. Christine Benz discusses how to turn a down market to your advantage, followed by Russ Kinnell's fun picks that provide safety in times of uncertainty. Next, Alex Bryan investigates how low volatility funds are faring during market downturns. In this low interest rate environment, our equity analysts share two picks for stocks with burly dividends. Then Mark Miller breaks down the differences between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Let's get started. First, Christine Benz provides insights into how to turn a down market to your advantage.
Hi, I'm Susan Jubinski from Morningstar.com. The recent stock market turbulence hasn't felt very good, but Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance, Christine Benz, has four ideas for how investors can use the downturn to their investing advantage. She's here today with me to discuss them. Christine, thank you for being here.
Susan, it's great to be here.
Now, one of the things you've talked about quite a bit in the past is that, you know, there are a lot of things that investors can't control during turbulent markets. Yes.
Most.
But one of the things that we can control is how we're contributing and how much we're contributing to our investment accounts. How should we be thinking about that in this type of market?
Right. I think that's a really good take control strategy when things are feeling really uncertain. You do control your own savings rate. And so to the extent that you can add to your contributions during these periods of market weakness, that actually amplifies your long-term returns. It's what one fund manager said is like, you make your money at times like this, you just don't know it at the time. So if you are in the position to increase your contributions, it's a great time to think about doing it. It's not to say that there won't be more turbulence to come. There very well could be. But by increasing your contributions, you're putting more money to work when stocks are down. That's never a bad thing.
Also, during times of market turbulence, you recommend that there could be some tax-saving strategies that we could be pursuing or thinking about. What are those?
Absolutely. So if you have taxable assets, non-tax-sheltered assets, take a look at whether some securities that you purchased at a higher price are now selling at a lower price. You can capture that tax loss, use the loss to offset capital gains that you might have on your books, or even up to $3,000 in ordinary income. So take a look at that. If you have tax-sheltered assets, traditional IRAs specifically, when the market goes down, that tends to be a better time to convert those traditional IRA assets to Roth because the taxes that you'll owe are based on that lower balance. So that's another thing to consider. Definitely get some tax advice with either strategy, but those can be a way to kind of make a save in a difficult market.
Now, you've noted in the past that volatile times are actually a really good time to check up on your asset allocation. But let's say that the market is sort of falling. Is that really a time to tweak our asset allocation?
Well, it may be. And so I think what you really want to be thinking about is your time horizon. If you're a younger investor, many years to retirement, probably don't even look at what plan that you've laid unless you were really conservative for some reason. But if you are getting close to retirement, even though the market has come down a little bit, I still think it's a good time to get in there, take a look at your asset allocation, especially if you're within like 5 to 10 years of retirement. See what your allocation to safe securities looks like. If you haven't done anything, it may be lower than in fact what it should be.
And the last point is, you know, the Federal Reserve lowered the Fed funds rate by 50 basis points the other day. And while that's bad news for owners of some safe assets looking for yield, that is good news for borrowers. So what should borrowers be thinking about?
A couple of things. If you have a mortgage, you may consider refinancing. You may be able to refinance at a lower rate or even go to a shorter term where there are typically lower rates available. So check that out if you still have a mortgage. Also, think about mortgage pay down, so accelerating your mortgage payments, especially if you intend to stay in your home. And the basic reason you'd consider doing that is look at the yields on safe securities. As you said, Susan, they're really low. Your mortgage interest rate is probably higher than that. So retiring your debt may be a better use of your funds.
Christine, thank you so much for joining us today. These are a lot of great practical things that we can be doing today in this market uncertainty.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jubinski from Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa.
Now, Russ Kinnell's recommendations for funds that provide safety in a stormy market.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Volatility in the market has picked up of late, to say the least. Joining me to share some of his favorite mutual funds that can help investors weather turbulent times is Russ Kinnell. He's Morningstar's Director of Manager Research. Russ, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Russ, it has been an extremely volatile period in the market. Let's talk about why or whether you think investors should brace themselves for more volatility to come.
Yeah, well, you know, in this case, we're talking about market reaction to the coronavirus.
Right.
And of course, we don't have a clue what's going to happen with the coronavirus, and even the medical experts don't. So
right.
I won't venture there just to say that that's a real unknown. What one part of it that is known is we know this has already had a big economic impact. China's drastically dialed down their economy and their growth, and that's starting to have ripple effects throughout the rest of the world. And also the virus has spread to more parts of the world. And we're having, I think, a different reaction than we're seeing to past epidemics, where really governments are just almost shutting down mm-hmm. cities and businesses. And so though the one part is really unknown, we do know that the impact on the economy is real. But obviously, we don't know how big it's going to be on the economy.
Right.
We don't know how it's going to be on the markets. But certainly, it's a very sobering event, and it seems logical that the markets would go down. I have no idea if our current 10% sell-off is the correct amount, but it certainly makes sense to me.
Okay. And another, I guess, headwind would be the fact that equities coming into this were not especially cheap, arguably are still not extremely cheap, and so that might stop stocks from mounting an immediate recovery.
That's right. The markets are certainly vulnerable because they've had such a big rally
right.
that a lot of good things were priced in. So, again, I think I wouldn't simply say that we know that 10% is a good part or that, you know, more than this is overreacting. We really can't say.
We don't know. Okay. So let's get into some ways that investors can think about this. If they're approaching their portfolios, it seems like thinking about their asset allocations is a good starting point. So for investors who haven't looked at their portfolios recently and maybe run the numbers and say, well, gosh, it looks like I'm probably still a little overweight equities given my age, given my proximity to retirement, let's talk about some good or a good kind of core fixed income fund that investors might look to.
Yeah, one I like is Fidelity Intermediate Bond. It's one that really focuses on issue selection, only modest macro plays and kind of stays right down the middle. Since we split up our core bond and intermediate core plus categories, we made a lot more clear which ones are on the conservative side, and core plus, of course, are more aggressive. So I would say shop in for a medalist in that core area, and I think Fidelity is a very nice, dependable choice among them.
Okay. So investors might look at fixed income and say, are you too crazy because we've seen yields go really low? Let's just talk about the role of fixed income assets in investor portfolios, even if yields aren't especially compelling.
Right. And to set the context, I think we're talking about rebalancing into bond funds, not dumping all your stock
right.
funds. You know, you don't want to panic. You want to make sure that you're on your plan. And if you haven't touched your plan, your portfolio in a while, your equity exposure, even after this sell-off, may be above what you're targeting. So we're suggesting moving into bonds. And you're right, yields are not great. This is not how you get rich. This is how you play defense so that other parts of your portfolio can take on greater risk and still allow you to sleep at night. So high-quality bonds tend to have low correlation with equities. And so in years like 08, 09, you feel really good that you own them because generally they actually make money in downturns. Occasionally they just lose less. But in any case, that diversification helps. It helps you to stay in your more aggressive holdings so that you can still reach your goals.
Okay. Another strategy investors might consider as sort of an all-weather strategy versus really even worrying about their asset allocation mixes is simply to buy a good one-stop fund that adjusts for their asset allocation based on their age. Let's talk about target date funds. I know that you and the team have several series that you like that are highly rated. Let's talk about T. Rowe Price's series. This has historically been a pretty strong entrant in this target date space.
This is a target date series we really think highly of because there's some very strong Underlying funds from T. Rowe. T. Rowe is pretty good across the board in various asset classes, but also T. Rowe has built out their team. Their target date team is now a very deep, strong team. Target date funds have become much more important in a lot of the big fund companies. And so if you're a T. Rowe or a Fidelity, you're naturally going to invest in that area because it's really important. And so that's what T. Rowe has done. And so our analysts in our target date group really have warmed up to T. Rowe's area now. And I would say, I would caution that the T. Rowe target date funds do run to the aggressive side on equities.
Have more stocks, yeah.
So if you don't want that, then someone like a Vanguard might be a better choice. But I think T. Rowe is a very strong offering.
Okay. And you monitor investor behavior through fund flows. Target date funds look really good from that standpoint, right?
Target date funds bring out the best in investors for a couple of reasons. One is they're boring performers for the most part. They're super diversified and so tend to have modest gains and modest losses.
Okay.
And I would also just mention that because they're in 401ks, people invest every couple of weeks. And even in 08, 09, almost all those people in target date funds in 401ks just kept investing. So it really does bring out good behavior.
Okay. Let's talk about a static allocation fund that would blend different asset classes. Those two can make sense for investors who really don't want to spend a lot of time managing their portfolio's asset allocation. One you and the team like is Vanguard Life Strategy Growth. You like all of the Vanguard Life Strategy funds. I'm guessing low expenses are part of the thesis. What else?
Low expenses, diversification, they're very wide-ranging portfolios. They essentially have 20% increments of equity. So Life Strategy Growth is an 80% equity fund. But if that's too much, it can go down to 60, 40, et cetera. So I like the fact that, as you say, they are kind of set it, forget it. We mentioned earlier how if you haven't touched your portfolio, it might have gotten out of balance a bit. These are funds that take care of that for you.
Yeah.
It's a set allocation, so they're always making these modest little rebalancings, which is really nice, plain, simple risk management tool. So just keep rebalancing, keep don't let your equity portion go crazy. But even in a down market, you're doing the other way. You're adding to equities, and so it's a really simple, sound strategy.
Okay, how about for investors who want to maintain ample equity exposure, but maybe be in a somewhat lower risk, equity-heavy portfolio? Let's talk about a couple of funds for investors like that. FPA Crescent is one that you and the team like. It's gold rated. Let's talk about the case for that fund.
Steve Romick is just a very good investor who blends equities with bonds and cash and has always been less than fully invested in equities and just kind of has a bit of an absolute return view of things. By that, I mean he's really focused on not losing money, so might lag the S&P 500 in some strong rallies, but still does a very good job. And if you look at its long-term performance, it's been about like the market with less volatility. I don't know if it can do quite that well in the future, but certainly the prospects are still very strong.
Okay. Another tried and true name is Vanguard Wellington. This is kind of a multi-asset class fund as well, but still an ample equity weighting. Let's talk about the case for that fund.
Yeah, so if FPA Crescent is kind of a little quirky based on Steve Romick, this one, you have a big organization in Wellington, much less quirky, a value portfolio married to a high-quality bond portfolio, delivers some nice income, but also, again, because it's not a pure equity fund, it tends to be relatively stable. Because Wellington has a deep team, they've gone through manager changes, and it doesn't seem to really have a big impact on the fund, which is another way that it works as a nice set it and forget it fund.
Okay, Russ, it's always great to get your insights. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, Alex Bryan investigates how low volatility funds fare during market downturns.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar.com. Coronavirus fears have injected much uncertainty into the market. As such, investors may be looking for ways to de-risk their portfolios. Should low volatility funds be something to consider? Joining me today to discuss is Alex Bryan. Alex is Morningstar's Director of Passive Strategies in North America and Editor of ETF Investor. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's step back a little bit and first talk about what are low volatility funds and what are the different strategies that these funds use?
So low volatility funds are effectively strategies that try to provide investors a smoother ride than the overall market, which should translate into lower downside risk. The trade-off here is that you give up some of the market's upside, but over the long term, they should provide a more attractive risk-reward trade-off than the overall broad market. And there's a couple ways that these strategies are implemented, but that's the basic idea.
So let's talk a little bit about the different strategies. Tell us a little bit about the first one and maybe a couple of ideas you like there.
Yeah, so the simplest approach is to basically target stocks that have exhibited low volatility in the recent past based on the assumption that stocks with low past volatility will likely continue to exhibit low risk going forward. So if you think about this, this tends to tilt toward stocks like utilities, consumer defensive names, in some cases, healthcare names. These types of stocks tend to be a little bit less cyclical than most. So in times when the economy is not doing so well, they tend to have better earnings than the more cyclical stocks. So a fund in this group that I like is Invesco S&P 500 Low Volatility ETF. The ticker is SPLV. This fund effectively lines up the stocks in the S&P 500 based on their volatility over the past year and targets the least volatile 100. Now, one of the issues with this strategy is you do tend to get some very large sector concentrations from time to time. So this fund right now has a lot of exposure to utilities and to REITs. There's going to be times when that works out. There's going to be times when, that may not pay off. So it's important to keep that in mind. But overall, it's done a really good job of cutting downside risk.
And then there's a sort of another cadre, another group of low vol funds. Tell us a little bit about how they work and maybe a fund you like there.
Yeah, so the other approach is to take a more holistic approach to portfolio construction, where you're not just looking at past stock volatility, but also at how stocks interact with each other in a portfolio. So for example, if a stock like a gold miner has really low correlation with other stocks, it may actually make the cut for a low volatility portfolio, even though on its own, it may have high volatility. So a fund that I like here is the iShares Edge MSCI USA Minimum Volatility ETF. The ticker is USMV. This fund basically uses an optimizer to try to construct the least volatile portfolio possible under a set of constraints to improve diversification. This includes limiting sector tilts relative to the market. So what you end up with is a really well-diversified portfolio that mitigates exposure to sources of risk that you may not anticipate, but it also still favors those types of defensive names that you get with that Invesco fund that uses a more simplistic approach. But I do like this this type of strategy as a way of really building a strong core portfolio.
So sort of a million-dollar question is, how did these low-vol funds do last week when the S&P was down double digits?
Yeah, so last week was a bad week for the market. I mean, the S&P 500 lost more than 11%. And these two funds last week did about as poorly as the market did. And that, I think, brings up an important point. While these strategies have done a good job of cutting downside risk, if you look at the returns over any rolling one-year period that you want to look at, they're not always going to be down less than the market on days when the market is down. So if you have a really short-term horizon, if you're really worried about what's going to happen to the market this week or next week, you know, the better solution may be just to own more cash or more bonds and less in the stock market, because it's really hard to say whether these are going to do better or worse than the market over a very short window like that. But if you have a longer investment horizon, like let's say a year, 3 years, 5 years, I think it's a really good bet that in months when the market is down, these strategies should hold up a little bit better.
So are there any types of investors in particular who might be more or less interested in pursuing these funds a little bit or learning more about them?
Yeah, I think these are really appealing strategies for risk-averse investors who still want exposure to the stock market. These funds are still going to participate in the market's upside. And over the long term, that's been a good place to be, but they help mitigate some of the volatility that you might otherwise get with a stock portfolio. Now, these are still stock funds. They're still 100% invested in the stock market. So these are not, should not be seen as bond replacements. They're still going to be risky. They're still stock funds. But I think if you are more risk averse, these are very appealing types of strategies to look at. As I mentioned, I think the iShares fund, which uses this more holistic approach to portfolio construction, might be a better core holding for a risk averse investor. And the Invesco fund, which uses this more pure approach of just targeting stocks with low volatility, that might be a better satellite holding for someone who just wants to tilt their portfolio a little bit toward defensive stocks, because while it is more style pure than the iShares fund, it does have those sector risks that come into play. So if you're going to own that fund, it's better to keep that a small portion of your overall portfolio.
Alex, I want to thank you again for your time today. Great information.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar.com. Thank you for tuning in.
Now, equity analysts Ali Magarabi and Aaron Lash share two picks for stocks with burly dividends.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar.com. In a low interest rate environment, income-producing stocks are particularly attractive. After all, dividend producers can deliver yields on par with or even better than bonds, along with the opportunity for capital appreciation. Today, we're highlighting some stocks that were recently added to the Morningstar Dividend Yield Focus Index, which consists of high-quality, high-yield U.S. stocks screened for consistent records of dividend payments and the ability to sustain them in the future.
Ad holding company Interpublic Group of Companies, or IPG, is now trading close to our $26 fair value estimate, as it has nicely come up 8% year-to-date, higher than S&P 500's 2.5%. While it's fairly valued at these levels, it has differentiated itself by outperforming its peers, making smart data acquisitions, maintaining organic growth in North America, strengthening the balance sheet, and increasing the dividend that's yielding over 4% at IPG's current price. IPG's one-stop-shop strategy that includes creativity integrated with data and technology offerings is attracting new clients and giving them reasons to spend more. With strength from clients in the United States, IPG keeps growing organic revenue at a higher rate than most of the other major ad holding companies. All of this is accompanied by margin expansion, which we think will continue this year. The company keeps strengthening its balance sheet. It retired around $400 million in debt last year. And after the $2.3 billion acquisition of data and technology company Acxiom in 2018, it's good to see the lower leverage ratio of 2.3 down from 2018's 2.6 and comfortably below the 3.75 covenant. With that, we're comfortable it can continue to increase dividend going forward, as it did recently by 9%. We look for IPG to continue organic growth in developed and emerging markets, expand margins, and further increase dividends for shareholders.
Wide Moat Clorox has long been an exemplary steward of shareholder capital. The firm has paid and increased its dividend every year for more than 40 years, growing its dividend at a mid to high single digit clip over the last 5 to 10 years, maintaining its payout ratio around 60% of earnings on an annual basis. And we expect the firm will continue down this path, prioritizing returning excess cash to shareholders, with our forecast calling for mid-single-digit annual dividend increases and the payout ratio hovering around its historical averages. Despite this, we don't believe the firm's valuation is attractive at present, trading at nearly a 20% premium to our $139 fair value estimate and offering investors a mere 2.5% dividend yield. For investors looking to gain exposure to the consumer product space, we'd suggest investors look to Wide Moat Kellogg, which is trading at nearly a 20% discount to our $78 fair value estimate and offers a nearly 3.5% dividend yield.
Expand your investing horizons and look to the long term with Morningstar's new podcast, The Long View. Join hosts Christine Benz and Jeff Patak as they talk to influential leaders in investing, advice, and personal finance. Search for and subscribe to The Long View today. And lastly, Mark Miller breaks down the differences between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
the decision about whether to choose Medicare Advantage or traditional Medicare can be surprisingly impactful. Joining me to shed some light on this issue is Mark Miller. He's a Morningstar contributor. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here.
Mark, let's talk about the basic differences between Medicare Advantage or traditional Medicare. I hit a fork in the road when I'm Medicare eligible. What are the major differences between the two plans?
Yeah, and this is really decision one that people need to think about. And everything kind of proceeds down two different parts of the decision tree from that decision. A traditional Medicare is the program we've had since the mid-60s. It's fee-for-service Medicare. You can see just about any healthcare provider you want to. When you enroll, you're enrolled in Part A, which is covers hospitalization, Part B, which is outpatient services, usually a Part D drug plan, and some kind of supplemental coverage is definitely recommended because Medicare doesn't have built-in caps on out-of-pocket. And so people usually do that with a Medigap plan. Some people get that coverage through a former employer or a union, let's say. Some people get that protection from Medicaid if they're low income. That's the traditional program.
Okay.
Medicare Advantage is a relatively newer phenomenon. It really got going in around 2006. And it's a privately offered, commercially offered, managed care alternative to the traditional program. So you continue to pay your Part B premium, but instead of using that to present at just about any doctor, you have elect to join a Medicare Advantage plan offered by an insurance company. It's managed care. It's generally an HMO, sometimes PPO. So those are structures most working people are familiar with these days. In that sense, it's not that much different. It's all-in-one coverage. You generally don't sign up for standalone Part D coverage, although sometimes people do. It depends on the plan you join. Many have drug coverage rolled right in.
Okay.
And you don't get supplemental coverage because Advantage plans do have their own cap on out-of-pocket built in. It's a relatively high out-of-pocket. It averages about $5,000 a year. In return for accepting the network limitations, which you know are typical HMO limitations.
That you can't see every doctor that you want.
You have to see in-network physicians. Mm-hmm. You can see out-of-network people, but you're going to pay a bunch more. In return for that, you are also generally getting some extra services built in. Lots of Advantage plans come with gym memberships. Increasingly, they have some level of dental coverage. Not necessarily very robust, but some level of dental, some level of vision and hearing coverage. And there's a whole suite of new supplemental non-medical services that are just starting to be rolled in that are going to help people who are, let's say, are homebound, so community-based.
Who need in-home care.
Interesting things that go on there. But that's the two different choices.
Okay. So you say managed care, and that naturally makes me think that Medicare Advantage might be more cost-effective.
Right.
What is, in fact, the cost differential typically?
Right. So let's say you're just turning 65 and you're signing up for Medicare for the first time, and you look at Advantage and say, well, I can pay my Part B premium but not have to pay a separate Medigap premium, a separate Part D premium, got all these other extra benefits rolled
in.
Gym
membership, yeah.
Gym, you know, dental,
right.
Which is
huge.
Really a big deal. That's another topic.
Right.
But there's so many topics in Medicare. We could go on all day with this. But it looks very attractive. It may look cheaper to you. The thing that a lot of times gets missed is this, that when you first sign up for Medicare, you have the opportunity to buy a Medigap plan with pre-existing condition protections, meaning that the insurance companies that offer Medigap can't turn you down for a pre-existing condition, can't charge you more for a pre-existing condition. And you can sign up with those protections from 6 months past the point that you sign up for Part B. That's your window for that protection. And then it's gone. With the exception of four states that have some level of guaranteed enrollment with pre-existing condition on an ongoing basis, and those are on the East Coast. They're Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, and Maine has some more limited protections. But everywhere else, if you don't choose traditional Medicare with a Medigap in that window, that pre-existing condition protection's gone, which means that if at some later point you wanted to revert to traditional Medicare, you may well have a hard time getting a Medigap. That effectively makes it impossible to go back to traditional Medicare, or I would say inadvisable, because you're going to have no protection for potentially large out-of-pocket costs. And so this is a point I've been trying to hammer home with people. What I think often happens is the attractiveness of the cost savings and the extra benefits obscures a consideration of the long-range implications of the decision. So you're 65, you're hopefully healthy,
right,
still working out at the gym and all that. You're not necessarily thinking about what's going on when you're in your 80s, or late 70s, and maybe have a serious condition that's going to require, and you're going to want more flexibility, let me put it this way.
Of providers and so forth.
You know, a story that I just wrote in the New York Times talks about one couple that did just this. The guy was attracted to all the extra benefits. Then 8 years later.
Of advantage.
8 years later, receives a serious illness diagnosis of an aggressive form of cancer. As I would do, he's nosing around in his hometown to find out who is the person you want to see in Chicago.
Of course,
who is the expert on my condition. And this is a natural reaction we would all have with a life-threatening illness. And guess what? That provider and the medical center are out of network. Oh, well, so I'll just go back to traditional Medicare. But, you know, he's got this problem. So he's pretty much stuck with Advantage now. He's been able to kind of navigate through it and get to the provider he wants to see. But this is the thing that concerns me about Advantage, is that you know, it comes with some things that look attractive, but there really can be some serious ramifications from a care and provider standpoint down the road.
Okay. So I guess another takeaway is sort of people might have this sense that I could do some switching, but it isn't that easily navigated because of this pre-existing condition.
Because of the Medigap problem. Yes, technically you can move back in traditional Medicare, but can you get a Medigap?
Okay. So how about health outcomes when you compare Medicare Advantage plans versus traditional Medicare? Do the data say anything about where people are better off?
I'd say it's inconclusive. There's been a lot of research, a lot of serious academic research on it that is inconclusive. Some of the research points to some better outcomes for Advantage patients than traditional in areas like preventive care, for example, which would stand to reason because that's a strength of managed care approaches.
You're not going to feel any disinhibition to go see a doctor because
But there also have been some studies that point to very high rates of denial of care in Advantage because it's in the insurance company's interest to keep their costs down, maximize profits. So I think it's fair to say that there's not a consensus yet on that. I think you can get some healthy debate. The jury's out in some senses, but you know, maybe that Advantage is doing better in some areas and not so well in others.
Okay, Mark. Important topic. Thank you so much for being here to share this information.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. We hope you've enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@Morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.